what things material and things spiritual get in the way of our ability to be in relationship with others. For Francis, that was a big problem. He said, you know, Jesus didn't set up shop in some sort of high rise in Jerusalem. Jesus went out and met people physically. And famously in the Synoptics, Jesus says, you know, birds have nests and foxes have dens, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And for Francis, that was the model. Jesus was not withheld from anybody, right? So God incarnate goes out and meets people where they are.
Daniel P. Horan is director of the Center for Spirituality and professor of philosophy and religion at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame, Indiana. He's the author of several books, most recently, A White Catholic's Guide to Racism and Privilege, and The Way of the Franciscans, A Prayer Journey Through Lent, both published in 2021. A Franciscan friar, Dan is also an amateur but expert photographer, a runner, a podcaster, and the author of a thoughtful article on how a Franciscan perspective can help us navigate the complexities of faith crisis. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. All right, so Dan Horan, a couple weeks ago, we were in San Antonio sharing a table over dinner. And this is not quite as nice as that, but still, it's really nice to see you over Zoom this morning. Thank you.
Great to be with you, Matt.
Now, I was telling you right before we got on today, I've got a theory about you. I'll share it right now. My theory is that you're actually a twin, maybe a triplet, all operating under the name Daniel P. Horan, because you do so much work. You write, what, a book a year, sometimes two, you know, and you are a busy, busy soul. So I am especially grateful that you're coming on here. By the way, is my theory right?
It's not, unfortunately. I wish I had some doppelgangers or something like that, where maybe they could take some of the work and I can get more sleep. But no, in all seriousness, it's a very kind observation and a hopeful wish. I am the oldest of four boys in my family, and that family keeps growing in terms of my siblings' family members, but no twins in the mix yet.
Okay, all right. So much for that theory. All right. So I begin by asking my guests how faith figures into their life and work. And in your case, you're a Franciscan friar and a Roman Catholic priest, right? As well as a professor at a university. So perhaps I can begin by asking you when it was you felt called to a life in the priesthood, and was the desire to work at a university born at the same time?
I can answer that sort of in reverse order. No, for sure. The kind of call to religious life or to ministry was something that I felt from a pretty early age. So as you mentioned, I'm in the Roman Catholic tradition. I grew up in upstate New York, primarily through primary school and high school and so forth, and came from a fairly, devout Catholic family, but not superly devotional or pietistical. We went to church every weekend, every Sunday, and, in this increasingly secular age that we're going to talk about, that itself is something distinctive. And my parents also really valued education. And so they put all four of us boys through Catholic private school from kindergarten all the way through high school. And so it was that exposure to religion in the classroom that was always something that helped informed, I would say, my imagination and my way of seeing the world, that presence in the Roman Catholic liturgy, going to mass every Sunday, really helped sort of foster that reflection. And I would say by the time I was in fifth or sixth grade, I just found myself continually drawn to what was going on in worship, what was going on in the liturgy. And by the time I was in high school, that thought had not quite dissipated yet. It was still with me. And it was a vague thought. The thought was, I want to be part of this. I'm drawn to this. I want to learn more about this. So I went off to college and studied theology and journalism. And it happened to be a Franciscan university, St. Bonaventure University in Western New York, right now doing pretty well in the NCAAs. I think we're...
It's true, yeah.
I don't know what it was on Monday, but we were 16th as of over the weekend. And BYU is up there too, I think, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So if you, that tangent is reflective of my love of college basketball, but went to St. Bonaventure and there met the Franciscans. And I, like most people, most Christians, had heard of Francis of Assisi, knew his love of creation and animals. But it was studying theology and philosophy. It was getting to know the Franciscan friars in a relational way, in a first person way, that by the time I was ready to graduate from college, I had this thought, I need to give this a try. And if it's not for me, if through prayer and discernment and reflection, I realize God's calling me to something else, no harm, no foul. But it was just such a strong feeling that I knew I'd regret it if I didn't give it a try. And that was almost 17 years ago now. And so it's been a journey.
Yeah, for sure. It's a great journey. I love, by the way, the basketball reference, no harm, no foul, in the middle of your description about this. That captures, right, these two things that came up there in the response. So it's commonly perceived, in our era, that tensions arise between faith and learning, right, the religious and the secular. Now, you're a very active and productive scholar, and you write about a wide variety of subjects. And my question here is whether you've had to negotiate tensions between your faith and your studies, or have you found that the two actually usually work with utter harmony?
Well, that's really well put. I think aspirationally, theoretically, they should work in greater harmony. I don't know if they work in absolute harmony or can on this side of life. But, one of the interesting things about the Catholic tradition is, going back to very early in Catholicism and Christianity, and certainly by the time you get to the High Middle Ages, there was this understanding of the kind of mutual relationship between fides et ratio, faith and reason, that, the way we understand the world, the various forms of human inquiry and knowledge and learning, that this should not be antithetical to what's revealed in sacred scripture, what's revealed through tradition, through experience, through the life, death, and resurrection of Christ, and so forth. So, that's something that sadly at times has not always been remembered, has not always been emphasized. In fact, about 30 years ago, John Paul II, former pope in the Catholic Church, issued an encyclical letter, a teaching document titled Fides et Ratio, kind of drawing attention again to this sort of core element. In my own life, I do find challenges with that in my research, in my teaching, in my ministry. And the tensions arise, I think, oftentimes when people perceive, well-intentioned people of great faith, perceive an incapacity to align between faith and reason. So, even though the official teaching in the Roman Catholic Church, for instance, is that, biological theory of evolution is not in contradistinction to, what's revealed in scripture and in the tradition. Nevertheless, there are a lot of people who have this kind of stereotypical view that like science and religion are antithetical. They don't get along. But that's one of the great blessings, as I'm sure you experience in the classroom in your own field, of helping people to come and see that actually what you thought you might know as problematic is actually perhaps a slight misunderstanding, and how can we clarify that? So, today I see that in my own work, particularly around issues of social analysis and psychology and medical science, where some of our foundational theological presuppositions are not tenable. And I, to paint with a broad brush, I would say that there are a lot of teachings in the church, the core of which is really important, the core of which, the values of which need to be maintained, but the details of which rest upon, let's say, a 13th century scientific understanding, which just does not work today. So I find myself, in terms of my theological work, maybe more to distinguish that from perhaps the work of the academic study of spirituality, is a focus on how do we renew through the tradition the foundations so that we can engage in this relationship, this dialogue, this mutual learning between faith and reason, as you say.
That's great. I love that, Dan. I think that's very well said. And I'm a believer also that there's a need to draw upon learning, understanding, science, et cetera, to inform what we know about the world, certainly to inform what we know faithfully also about the world, but that there has to be some way to be able to reconcile these things through ongoing understanding, inspiration, revelation, discernment, et cetera, right? And this is the task, I think, it's a task of really good thinkers of theology. It's certainly a lot of what you do in your work, which I really admire about what you do. On that subject, right, so you've written several books, but I'm talking with you today about a much smaller thing that you wrote, which is this really lovely article you published in the recent issue of Spiritus, which is the flagship journal for the Society for the Study of Christian Spirituality. And your article is titled Spirituality in a Wintry Season, The Wisdom of the Franciscan Tradition in the Quest for Meaning Today. And I wonder if I could ask you about the first part of that title, Spirituality in a Wintry Season. It's a provocative line. Can you tell us how you found it?
Sure. It's I can take virtually no credit for it. and that's because it was really coined in passing, actually, and interviewed late in his life with the great German Jesuit theologian Karl Rahner, who was very, very influential, certainly in the Roman Catholic tradition, but beyond Catholicism into many other Christian communities, and particularly in the academic theological realm. And in this, toward the end of his life, he was engaging in a lot of these interviews, and people really wanted to kind of pick his brain. You know, what do you make of the Trinity today? What do you make of Christology today? What do you make of the human person or the world today? And he coined this phrase, you know, that right now the challenge is that we are people of faith in a wintry season. And what he meant by wintry season is that with an increasing sort of experience of secularity, which he didn't inherently view as bad. And I think that's really important because I'm in alignment with that. I would say that oftentimes there's this, you know, I mean, this goes back actually 1700 years to Augustine's time, and you know, to the time of Constantine, where there's sort of these like strict divides that were drawn between so-called the profane and the so-called, you know, sacred, you know, and so the secular versus the sacred. And in truth, you know, Rahner, who was deeply, deeply, not only a brilliant theologian and philosopher, but a man of prayer and a man of great spirituality, you know, somebody who recognized that if we believe what it is we say we believe, that God's presence draws near to us at all times, that God in the first instance reveals and gives God's self as gift to us as grace, then what does this artificial line mean? You know, isn't everything in some sense touched by God's grace? So he says, okay, that doesn't change, right? However, our experience, the sort of phenomenon of moving through the world in an age of the 20th century and now 21st century, where religion isn't necessarily presupposed or any kind of experience of the transcendent is not necessarily presupposed, however it's presented, it appears almost like, and this is where the metaphor comes in, like wintertime in the Northern Hemisphere, where the leaves are gone and it's cold and it's frigid and it's dry. And it looks like everything's dead, you know, that vast landscape that's like the planet Hoth in Empire Strikes Back in the Star Wars trilogy, you know, fewer, you know, lasers and bombs and such. But you know, if we imagine this kind of frigid, cold, wintry season, what Rahner says is it appears as if faith is dead. It appears as if the world is dead. But beneath the surface, you know, with the sap of the trees, with the hibernating animals underground and in caves, with the life that continues to teem beneath the many layers of snow and soil, life is there. We just need to attune ourselves to see it. You know, it takes a little bit more effort. And so wintry season, I think, it's a beautiful image. It's I think, a dynamic image that helps us to think about what a lot of people experience today, which is a sense sometimes of hostility toward religious traditions and institutional belonging. But more often than not, a lot of incredulity. You know, I don't think there's something here, or more often than not, I would say, and I think this might be true with the LDS church as it is with Roman Catholicism and other communities, which is that those people who embrace a religious tradition are kind of viewed as a bit nuts. You know, we're kind of off the beaten path. You know, if I can, this goes against sort of stereotypes of Catholics, but to quote St. Paul in the first letter to the Corinthians, which is, he opens this up by saying, you know, Christianity, what we claim to believe is going to be absolute foolishness to those who operate according to the logic of the world. And I think, you know, this is, I bring that up in part because I think Rahner is tapping into exactly that core element of Christian faith, which is, it's always been crazy. It's always been foolish. It's always been bizarre. It was from the beginning. And that's not inherently a problem. That's why I think in this article, I try to make an optimistic kind of view, one that's rooted in, I think, authentic hope, as opposed to sort of delusional optimism, that this sense of a wintry season, it may appear stark, it may appear hostile, it may appear rough, yet God's presence continues to draw near to all people in this time. The challenge for us is, do we have the resources, the language, you know, the restructuring, perhaps a renewal of our institutions to help especially younger women and men come to recognize God's presence in their life? So that's where the wintry season comes in. And I love that image so much.
It's a beautiful image. I really love it too. And there's actually, there's a a former church leader, you know, who's, you know, passed away a couple decades ago, but very influential, Neil A. Maxwell, in my faith tradition, actually used the phrase wintry doctrine to describe some of the things that I think he must have gotten that from Rahner, or else the image is just so evocative. He found it just, you know, through inspiration on his own, but it's a beautifully evocative image. And you described that fantastically. You know, you quote, and I'll just, this is a way to kind of underscore what you just said in a way, but you quote someone in your article, the theologian Elizabeth Johnson, and she writes, and this is kind of, again, elaborating what you just said, but she said, I'm quoting here, to be a Christian now requires a personal decision, the kind of decision that brings about change of heart and sustains long-term commitment. However, when a person does come to engage belief in a personal way, society makes this difficult to do. You know, and that's just what you just spoke about a moment ago. And it does seem to me to be, on the one hand, a perennial issue. I mean, faith is never easy. I don't care if living in the 21st century or the 13th century at some level. But there are things that are different now, even from when I was, say, 20 years old. So I'm in my mid-50s now. Let's go back 30, 35 years. It's different still, again, I think, than it was a generation back. My kids don't live in the same world that I lived in, for example, when I was their age.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, what's interesting is this current generation, the generation that is in college right now, the kind of older Gen Z group, you know, so high school, college, maybe, you know, primary school age, you know, their challenge is different than my challenge as a young Gen Xer or an old millennial, depending on how you slice it, or yourself, you know, the generation prior. I think, you know, it's interesting. And I talk about this a bit in the article, you know, somewhat obliquely, but I'm thinking about them a lot. And at the pre-conference for the American Academy of Religion that you and I were at for the Society of Study of Christian Spirituality, this was something that was discussed a little bit. And this belief that I have that this generation right now, because of the context in which they've been reared, which is entirely digital, it's entirely, in many ways, virtual, they've been advertised to, they've been bombarded with so much information and distractions, and they've been kind of appealed to in all kinds of ways that, you know, we, myself included, we didn't experience growing up. Because of that, I think they have this interesting detector, kind of a soul detector, where they can, as I like to say, detect BS a mile away. They know what a spin is. They know what it means to kind of have a political argument leveled at them. They know what it's like to be advertised to. And so there is still, you know, they're cynical on one hand. And I think that's where a lot of older generations stop. They say, oh, these kids, they don't want to belong to institutions. They don't want to buy homes. They have resistance to, you know, institutions like that of marriage or what have you. And that's actually not the way I read it at all. And part of that arises from trying to, and not saying I have all the answers or that I'm attuned to this perfectly, but trying to listen to what they're actually saying. What I see is a deep desire for authenticity. So that goes to church leaders. It goes to parents and grandparents and older siblings. It goes to their teachers and educators and civil leaders. And I think, you know, what I see an opportunity there for people of faith is to recognize actually that they may be prophets in a way that we have not been accustomed to, in that they are moving through and cutting through a lot of the stuff that maybe we've just kind of been going through the motions about. And that's what I think Beth Johnson's getting at too, when she says, you know, even when people come to engage in belief in a personal way, they decide, you know, yes, this is right, I'm on board. Society makes it difficult to do. And I think, you know, society makes it difficult in this time in a way that's, you know, distinct from previous times and perhaps future times. So, but again, I keep coming back to this notion that God's Spirit draws near indefinitely. And so, you know, how do we make that connection?
I think that's beautifully said, Ben. I love that vision that you articulate. I think it's really, it's hopeful. And I think it's also very discerning. It's very true what you say. Let me ask you about some aspect of that. So on the one hand, okay, so people, you know, Gen Z, you know, they're very seasoned to understand spin when they perceive it. They know it. They've been raised in a culture saturated with information. So they're very attuned to that on the one hand. On the other, I'm going back to something you said when we first began our conversation about how you were raised, you know, your parents put you through Catholic school. and how this kind of worked on your religious imagination. You know, would you say that the religious imagination is available to people, you know, kind of your standard Gen Zer, along with that sensitivity to spin, to nonsense? Or would you say that they are, you know, sort of super attuned to what's wrong without necessarily a corresponding benefit of the same kind of imagination that you felt was given to you through your education when you were young?
That's such a great question, Matt. I think, you know, so this is where those of us who are engaged, right, in the academic study of spirituality are always concerned about, you know, first order, second order reflections. And, you know, at the first order, this is something that is really experience based, right? It's an experience of the transcendent, it's experience of the divine, it's experience of God. And one of the things that's interesting about that is, you know, and I make mention, I think, in the article about this and in language of the capacity for God, that each human person, by virtue of our being loved into existence by the Creator, has this inherent relationship to God. Rahner speaks about this, I think, very well, if in very kind of convoluted high German, with this idea that we can, you know, that everyone has this capacity and that on some level we're all sustained by, you know, divine mystery. That's a fact. Two things can be true at the same time. And yet, because of human freedom, the gift that God has given us, we can choose to just ignore it. We can choose to deny it. We can choose to walk away. And so that's always been the case, as you said earlier, right? Whether it's the 13th century or the 21st century, what have you. It's a very insightful question you raise about the role of the religious imagination. That's where I start to think of like secondary and maybe even tertiary reflection, which is that I am deeply convicted that young people today, as young people at all times, like all people at all times, have that kapax day, that capacity for God, have that relationship to God, have that yearning, you know, the Augustinian expression of, you know, our hearts are restless until they rest in you, O Lord, right? This kind of desire orientation toward the divine. The issue is, you know, there's a gap, I would say, between institutional religious affiliation, and I'm making a generalization here in the US context in particular, that inherent kind of human desire for the divine. There's a gap between those two things that young people have a hard time bridging today. So no, I don't think many young folks, even, you know, folks a generation or so after me, have had the experience of having a religious imagination formed in the same way, whether it's liturgical or whether it's more scripturally based or what have you, just because they're not there, right? They're not in the church, they're not in temple, they're not in these spaces. And yet, I'm interested in trying to bridge that gap. You know, in other words, what is the, can we give a lexicon? Can we provide a vocabulary or an imagination, like images and understandings to help give voice or name to that, which is that deep internal spiritual wrestling and restlessness, you know, that kind of tension that exists in young people. I think, you know, again, maybe I'm being overly optimistic and overly generous in my positivity toward this younger generation, but I think I find myself needing to occupy that space because so many people are so dismissive or cynical about them, as often is the case. But I do think that, you know, they're ready for it, but at the same time, they're not buying into a kind of overly glossed and overly marketed and you know, market tested sort of religious presentation. So, you know, they can see a mile away when your local church is like, oh, you know what we need to do to get young people more excited about the faith? We need a rock band, or we need to set up a cafe or like a fast food place in our lobby or something like this. You know, those kinds of things happen all the time and they're so ridiculous. I think young people, and I'll speak just, if I may, one example of where I'm getting this. In 2018, way back in the before times, before the pandemic, the bishops of the Catholic Church were engaged in a process called a synod of bishops, which happens every couple of years in Rome. And it's not all the bishops of the world, but it's representative bishops from around the world, about 200 usually, from all the continents, different regions. And the theme that year in the fall of 2018 was young adults in vocation. And in kind of an anticipation of the meeting of these bishops in October, Pope Francis called for young people themselves to come to Rome in the spring of 2018. And they had about 300 young adults, 18 to about 29 or 30, who were sent from all these dioceses, all these kind of regional churches around the world. So multiple languages, multiple social locations, experiences. And for a week, they worked in language groups and worked together and drafted a document at the end that really expressed where are young people today? And this is exactly the generation we're talking about. What are their desires? What are their hungers? What are the challenges they see? What do they want to see in the church? What is their message to the leaders of their faith community? And one of the things that kept coming up was authenticity. We want, you know, mentors who accompany us in our faith. We don't want to be told, wait your turn. We don't want to be told, you know, this is how we do it, take it or leave it. We want to recognize first and foremost that the people who are entrusted with leading our faith community have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, you know, and it sounds so like obvious. And yet I think the public face oftentimes of church leaders in the Roman tradition are bureaucrats, people who are getting caught up in like esoteric or controversial cultural issues that are not at the core of Christian faith. And these young people really called, you know, their brothers and for lay leaders too, brothers and sisters, into a sense of authenticity. You know, we want this, they say, we want to be part of this faith community. We are part of this. It's up to you to do what it is you say you believe. And so all that is to say, I think, you know, there is that hunger there. I think, you know, though it's a challenge to those of us who are older to say, like, are we actually doing what it is we say we are doing, walking the walk, as it were.
I love that vision of authenticity, Dan. And I also really love your vision, your optimistic vision, right, for Gen Z. I think that it rings true to me at multiple levels, which is why I was really drawn to this article you've written, which is really trying to address this in some kind of really substantive way and kind of addressing situations and people where they're at. Now, the point of your article, right, is to make a case for the ways the Franciscan tradition offers spiritual resources, right, for those navigating difficulties of the present moment. And you cite in the article three aspects of the tradition that seem especially relevant today. One is itinerancy, outreach to marginalized communities. And third would be a non-judgmental and inclusive approach to practitioners of other religious traditions and non-believers. And I wonder if we can take those kind of one by one and ask you about them. Itinerancy. Now, this doesn't mean, you know, wandering aimlessly through society or the hallways here in the building, like I sometimes do. Oh, there was itinerant Matt again. Doesn't mean that, right? Rather, as you say, that Francis insisted, I'm quoting you here, Francis insisted on going out into the world rather than retreating from it.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate?
Yeah, no, I think you're hitting the nail on the head, which is it's not any... it's not aimlessness. That's great. That's a great way to put a kind of a contrast out there. Itinerancy, as Francis of Assisi understood it, was really revolutionary because religious life up to that point, by and large, in the Christian tradition was one of monasticism. At least that was the primary model with some variation. And famously, there's this early kind of third and fourth century Latin phrase that's used to describe the kind of movement toward a monastic life, and it's fuga mundi, or fleeing the world. And the idea is that monks and nuns in their respective enclosed cloistered communities would enter into these spaces that were designed to be a kind of heaven on earth, where they would be shielded from the kind of daily concerns of the world. They could pray kind of without ceasing. They would live a simple life, but that their real commitment was to be kind of in this isolation, sort of you know, secluded from everything else. Francis, on the other hand, recognized in a way that, you know, it's not that monastic religious were somehow disinterested in the suffering of people in the world, but their understanding, their call was different. Francis wanted to go be with people. And so for him, you know, what leads to itinerancy is a more fundamental notion of evangelical poverty after the model of Jesus in the Gospels. And evangelical poverty isn't like a commitment to material or abject poverty for its own sake, right? That's sinful. That's harmful. That, you know, the prophets in the Hebrew Bible and Jesus himself rally against, you know, people suffering destitution, right? That's not what poverty means in Franciscan life. Instead, what it means is what things material and things spiritual, get in the way of our ability to be in relationship with others. So one material possession would be massive land and cloistered walls and big churches where we're separated physically, literally from others. Well, that's for Francis, that was a big problem. He said, you know, Jesus didn't set up shop in some sort of high rise in Jerusalem, right? Jesus went out and met people physically. And famously in the Synoptics, Jesus says, you know, birds have nests and foxes have dens, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And for Francis, that was the model. Nobody was, you know, or let me put it this way. Jesus was not withheld from anybody, right? So God incarnate goes out and meets people where they are. That's the primary model. And so, but there's a physical element to that, of course, right? So, you know, no dens, no nests, nowhere to lay his head. Jesus was dependent. There's a sense of interdependence there. There's a sense of, you know, I don't have to go and mow the lawn. I don't have to go and reshingle my house. I can be out there with people. And you know, there's some discomfort that comes with that as well. But another interesting thing about itinerancy is more the spiritual journey or the challenge internally, which is the things, you know, you may not have a lot of physical possessions, a home or many clothes or what have you, but you may hold on to judgments and views and prejudices that also get in the way of relationship. So, you know, Francis of Assisi, in one of his later writings, a little kind of sermon that he gave called An Admonition, talks about this as spiritual poverty. It's not, you know, a kind of, you know, a kind of reification or something of like some sort of abstraction, but for him, it was very practical. He said, you know, you may have very little physical material or possessions or belongings, but you may not be able to enter into a relationship because of your own views or prejudices, judgments, need to be right, need to have the last word, these kinds of things. So itinerancy is the goal, is the idea, it's the means by which one enters into relationship with whomever God places in your path. And that evangelical poverty is the condition of the possibility of doing that. So it's a challenge. It's an ongoing challenge. It's not like a one-off thing where it's like, oh, I became a Franciscan. I don't technically own a house or anything like this, even though I live in one and all this kind of stuff and get caught up in the material possessions. Francis says, what gets in the way of relationship in the model of Christ?
Really beautiful idea, Dan. And I love the thought. I love how you extend that into not just, you know, possessions, but judgments that we make, you know, as attitudes that we hold, ideologies to which we're, you know, kind of adhered. I really appreciate that a lot. And one of the things I really try to work on myself, how do you arrive at a sense of what's true about things without then going into a snap judgment morally about why it's good or bad? That is a reflex in me that does get in the way, I think, of relationship with people on occasion. And I work on that a lot myself. And I appreciate the really beautiful way you articulate that principle. And it kind of folds into the second one, right, which is solidarity with the marginalized. I'm curious how that's a Franciscan trait, or, you know, are you advocating are you suggesting that the Franciscan tradition teaches solidarity in a wide variety of forms, even to those of us who aren't necessarily Franciscan?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say there isn't a distinctive Franciscan form of solidarity, but exactly what you just said, Matt, in the second part of your question, which is, you know, it's something that sometimes ruffles the feathers of my fellow Franciscans, because I'm keen to say that there's nothing special about Franciscan spirituality. And then usually people start freaking out, you know, the Ignatian tradition. And of course, the Jesuits are so possessive about the exercises and Ignatius Loyola and the Benedictines, oh, you know, Benedict and all this kind of stuff. When it comes to the Franciscans, we, you know, there's a real humility that's required of us, because our rule, that is our pattern, our way of life that Francis authored and Claire authored for the Poor Claire sisters, begins this way. The rule in life of the Friars Minor is this: to live the holy gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, period. And then he goes on, what follows is an elaboration of that. But my perspective has always been, the Franciscan way of life is non-exclusive. I mean, if you're a Christian, if you're baptized, if you aspire to follow the gospel, you know, whatever Francis and Claire of Assisi do, what that spirituality presents is an invitation to everyone. You don't have to be, you know, wearing a brown robe, and you don't have to have OFM after your name or be, you know, a Roman Catholic or whatever. The Franciscan tradition is truly inclusive in that sense. So, you know, what is this notion of solidarity? Well, I think it's illustrated well in Francis's own life. There's a great medieval historian named André Vacher who has written a tremendous amount about the life of Francis of Assisi. And he had a book that was translated into English. He's a French, scholar. And about 10 years ago, a new academic biography of Francis. And in it, he says something very interesting about Francis of Assisi's conversion. So there's this kind of debate within the Franciscan circles about, you know, what was the tipping point for Francis of Assisi? Was it the fact that he was a prisoner of war in this kind of medieval battle between the city of Perugia and the city of Assisi? Was it the fact that he heard, as the tradition has it, the voice of Christ, whatever that means, whether an audible thing or a spiritual encounter from the San Damiano cross saying, you know, Francis, rebuild my church? Was it the fact that he heard the preaching of Matthew's gospel about going into the world, not taking anything with you, you know, neither sandals nor money sack and whatnot? Or was it something else, like his encounter with lepers, those who were ostracized, those who were not welcome in either civil society or ecclesial society of the time? And I kind of think it's a waste of time to try to identify a singular pivotal moment. I think all these things are instructive and insightful. But Vaucher says something very interesting about that encounter with the leper that has always stayed with me, which is that it was in showing mercy to somebody who society and the church said was owed nothing, who was basically a non-person. In showing mercy, recognizing the inherent humanity of this other, that Francis, in that encounter, then began to recognize the ways in which God was showing him mercy at all times. And it's really striking because oftentimes we think about it the other way around, right? As believers, like, oh, you know, I'm going to be good to others because I've had this powerful experience of Christ in my life or of God's intervention in some way. Now I'm going to go and share that with others. And actually, it's quite the opposite. It's in the drawing near to the other that then he recognized, oh, wait a minute, God is the one who has shown this love to me first. So that solidarity with the marginalized goes back to the very heart of the Franciscan movement. And again, tying, as you rightly said, it's tied to itinerancy and the notion of evangelical poverty. And I think it's an opportunity in each and every age to think anew, well, who are the marginalized? Who are the minoritized or the subjugated in our communities? And I would say, as a Franciscan friar, but also a scholar of Franciscan studies, to say, this is deeply, deeply relevant today, right? And so we might ask ourselves, who are those people we find discomforting or that I'm not sure about or I don't understand entirely? Who are those who are being scapegoated or marginalized in our community, in our churches, in our society? Those are the people that God is calling us to. At least that's what Francis models for us.
I think it's a beautiful vision, Dan, and it really resonates with me. It does very much. Thank you. And we'll talk about, actually, you give a couple of examples of kind of cases, right, in your article, where we can think about how these principles might apply in concrete ways. The third principle there is inclusion, and you may have addressed that already. If you want to say more about it, by all means, do. This is, you know, again, the three things: itinerancy and poverty, right, and the solidarity with the marginalized, and inclusion. Any more you want to say about inclusion before I ask you about these concrete cases that you get to?
Yeah, I think you've kind of named it well, that they really flow one from another. And so I think, you know, inclusion is probably the most intuitive, which is, you know, if I may, I'll just use one little anecdote that comes through the Gospels, which is a question I sometimes pose in retreat ministry or to my students, which is, now, who did Jesus exclude? Who did Jesus say, you're not welcome? And people pause and think for a little while and scratch their heads. And the truth is, no one. There are times in which people are excluded from the ministry of Jesus of Nazareth, but it's not him who's doing it, right? It's either self-exclusion, like famously the wealthy young man who walked away disappointed because he had many possessions. You know, there's a real Franciscan narrative for you. Or, and this is the part I think that I like to emphasize, it's us. It's the followers of Christ. It's the first disciples, right? It's the ones who hold the children away from Jesus. It's the ones who say, oh, you know, it's getting late, Lord. These people need to be fed and we don't have any food and we don't want to feed them. And Jesus says, you feed them, you take care of them, right? And up to the point where, you know, famously in Luke's gospel, you have the crucifixion narrative and Christ is up there on the cross. And even in his kind of like utter suffering and experience of pain and death, you know, he's not saying, oh, well, you're a sinner and you're a criminal and I'm not going to associate with you, you know? So there's that ministry even up to the point of his own death. I say that because inclusion is a deeply Christian value and it breaks my heart when I see within the Christian community particularly, but all people, all men and women of goodwill, excluding one another to say, like, you're not worthy to be here. You're not worthy of God's love. You're not worthy to worship in our space. That I find, and that's something that's, you know, maybe it's more a Roman Catholic issue in the United States these days, but I have an intuition that a lot of faith communities struggle with this too. You know, we are more exclusive than inclusive. And I think that's a deep scandal from the gospel perspective.
I agree. It could be more. And then I think it's a huge temptation actually in the modern world. We live in such a society that's so polarized and so tribal. And we often imagine that we get the strength to live by drawing closer to our own tribe. And to some extent, I think it's right that to sort of talk with those who share our faith can help build our faith. But on the other hand, be really careful because I'm going to go reflexively into, and those others over there that don't share a point of view, right, must be excluded somehow. It's a natural kind of human reflex for how we form identities, how we strengthen or solidify, you know, our positions, the things we believe in, our value systems. There's a real risk. It's like what I was saying, you know, I want to be able to sort of discern what's true without then snap judging it in the wrong kind of way. It's, you want to be able to sort of have strong communities without those becoming then exclusionary, right, in their nature. That's the difficult thing to walk.
Well, and it is. And I think your point about the polarization and the tribalism is so, so true. You know, And I think this is something that the Christian community over the centuries has struggled with as well. As we've, you know, one way to look at it is the fracturing, or, the, you know, other ways to look at it is just the multiple manifestations of God's Spirit in different contexts. But if we take that fracturing narrative, what we start to see is, well, we are not you. We are who we are. We form our identity, as you say, in opposition. So I think about this famously in the 16th century between, you know, the reformers, Martin Luther, for example, and the Roman Catholic Church, where, you know, 400 years later, the Lutheran Federation and the Roman Catholic Church in this dialogue come to realize that what was ostensibly the biggest point of contention around justification, like the theology of justification, we actually agree on the same thing. We're on the same page. In 1997, they have this joint declaration where it's like, oh, we were on the same page all along. As I've often said to my students, the problem is when you are ships in the night, you're talking past one another. You're not listening to each other. It's taken centuries and all the violence and all the discrimination and everything that's flowed from that. And what happened very quickly in the mid and late 16th century is oppositional. So the Roman Church has this ecumenical council, the Council of Trent, in which they're, you know, anathemizing, they're condemning the reformers, and they're doing their own version of the same thing. And in the process, they say, you know, well, Luther says sola scriptura, you know, wants to go back to the sources, the normative source, which is true for all Christians of theology is sacred scripture. And so he's saying scripture. So the Catholics, this is where that stereotype begins. We say, well, no, tradition. So there's this opposition, you know, we're not you, they're not us. And that there's no salvation in that. I mean, there's nothing in my eyes that is Christian about exclusion. But inclusion is deeply, deeply unsettling, as you rightly say, especially in our own time, when that oppositional way of thinking is so dominant. But inclusion is also really hard, because I think we all feel most comfortable when we're around people with whom we agree, who look like us, who act like us, who have similar kind of values. So what does it mean to, you know, again, Christ was criticized according to the Gospels in his own earthly ministry because he was associating with everybody, sinners and tax collectors and the self-righteous and these, you know, 12 clowns that he invited to follow him and never really got it, you know? And so that's not easy to do. And they crucified him. So I guess that's the lesson to those of us who strive to follow in the footprints.
That's right. It's the lesson. It's a tough lesson, but I think, but a really vital one. We're getting, you know, kind of toward the end of our time here to talk. I want to ask you about the conclusion of your essay. You provide two contexts, what I was calling cases. You call them contexts with the practice of spiritual renewal. And the first is the challenge of climate change. And the second is systemic racism. Now, you've written books about both of these issues, right? And I wonder if we could talk about them briefly here, as you do in your article. Climate change first, you know, it's massive, it's horrifying in implication and scale. How do you see this as a source of potential spiritual renewal?
Yeah, I think there are a couple different trajectories that may be, I think, fruitful sources of spiritual renewal. One of them is, again, going back to the basics. I really like what you said a second ago, Matt, in introducing climate change, which is, it's so massive, it's so overwhelming. This is something Pope Francis has highlighted in his own writings and teaching, where he says, you know, one of the greatest crimes, one of the greatest sins of women and men today is not kind of an active destruction of the environment. You know, I often say, you know, most of us are not rolling down to, you know, the nearest river or watershed and dumping a 50-gallon bucket full of crude oil or something to pollute. Like, that's not what we're doing. Instead, most of us are just indifferent. And something I've been reflecting on lately is what sounds like an oxymoron, but an active indifference. We want to not know. We want to not think about it. And so we occupy ourselves with lots of other things and distractions. And Pope Francis says that's on one hand, an understandable response to an overwhelming reality. So there's an invitation to just go, let's scale it back for a minute. And yes, there are things we can do practically speaking, you know, recycle, use less water, be mindful of our carbon footprints and the like. Those are all very important, actions and practices. But the spiritual element, and this is something where I think the Eastern Church, the Orthodox Church, has been very, very good in leading the way. And I think Pope Francis, likewise in the West, has been really vocal on this front, which is to talk about ecological conversion and this idea of conversio, of turning around. Can we, you know, we as a species, as human beings, have deluded ourselves into thinking that not only are we important in God's eyes, which is certainly true, and that we have important responsibilities, which is correct, nevertheless, we are creatures too, and that we are part of this creation. And the Franciscan tradition is one that has been a real, in the Western Christian churches, has been a real carrier of this wisdom that we find, of course, in sacred scripture, going back, as I like to point out, to Genesis 2, in the book of Job, in the Psalms, in Romans 8. I mean, we can find all these examples. And so one of the sources of spiritual renewal, I think, is a call to humility, right? Isn't that part of the faith journey, is that pride is always viewed as sort of a primary sin for humanity, and men in particular, historically. So what does it mean to be humble? Well, part of it is knowing our place within God's family of creation. We have an important role, important responsibilities and vocation, and yet we are creation too. We're deeply interdependent. We're material creatures. And so how do we relate to the rest of creation? I think that's a spiritual challenge as much as it is a practical challenge. And, you know, that's going to take various forms, but I think that Franciscan wisdom is one way to help people think through that.
Terrific. Thank you. The second one you talk about is systemic racism. I mean, such an issue on the mind of so many people, and rightly so these days. How is that an occasion, as you see it, for potential spiritual renewal?
Yeah. So, I actually wrote a column last week for National Catholic Reporter, where I'm a columnist, and I was really inspired by a book that came out recently from the Mennonite perspective, the Mennonite Christian tradition. And the title of the book is called Ben in the Struggle Toward or Pursuing an Anti-Racist Spirituality. And it reminded me of something that a dear friend and colleague of mine, Father Brian Massengale, a professor of moral theology at Fordham University, has talked a lot about. And that is, racism is a soul sickness. That's his phrasing. And it's always really struck me as a powerful truth that it's not just a systemic issue as much as it is. It's not just a structural issue or a kind of a collection of individual choices or kind of racially based animus. It's also something, if we are people of faith and we understand ourselves as holistically formed and called by God, then there's something that's wrong with our souls. There's a sickness. There's a spiritual disease that's present. And so, you know, where do we find, as we're thinking about, you know, it's interesting, in the Catholic tradition, we have this very important ecumenical council in the mid-20th century called the Second Vatican Council. And one of the last documents that the bishops of the world released as formal teaching for the church is called Gaudium et Spes. It's the pastoral constitution on the church in the modern world. And it begins by saying, you know, the joys and hopes, the griefs and anxieties of the women and men of this age are the joys and hopes, griefs and anxieties of the people of God. In other words, we cannot distance ourselves from anybody's struggles as much as we don't want to distance ourselves from a solidarity of joyfulness. But a little bit further on in paragraph 4, the document says, by virtue of our baptism, all of us are called by Jesus Christ to interpret the signs of our times in the light of the gospel. And I think that how do we see the world as Christians in particular? do we see the world through the lens of Scripture? Do we see the world through the lens of God's revelation and what God is calling us to? Or are we trying to reinvent the wheel or trying to kind of come up with our own strategies and plans? When I talk about the spiritual renewal or spiritual element to systemic racism, there are practical elements that we need to take into consideration. And there are concrete things that can be done and be done immediately. But also there is this invitation to, like with climate change, to a humility, especially for people who are like me, who are identified or identify as white, and especially as a white man in the United States. So I think, you know, that's one of the things I would emphasize is that, you know, spirituality is a sense of holism, you know, this kind of inclusion that we've been talking about. And so when we talk about the way that people suffer and we talk about the way that people unwittingly benefit from systems of injustice, there's a spiritual element for people of faith. And I think the Franciscan tradition offers insight along those lines.
It's a great, again, I've said this before in a conversation today, but it's a great vision, Dan. And it's really large-minded and rigorous, what you are articulating in this article, for ways to really imagine spiritual renewal and providing contexts where that renewal is most obviously needed. And I learned a lot from this, and I took a lot of inspiration from it too. You mentioned that you're a reporter, you're a columnist for the National Catholic Reporter, and you know, you are a prolific writer and always a compelling writer. And I appreciate both the poignancy of what you say and the frequency with which you say it. I think both those things are important, right? To speak with insight and to speak it frequently, I think, to make sure people don't forget and people see this kind of vision you're articulating. Thank you so much for the article that you wrote. Thank you for the vision that you shared. And for taking the time to talk today. I think this will be something that a lot of people will be grateful to learn about and think about. So again, thank you very much, Dan.
Thank you, Matt. It's been a total pleasure. The time flies by when you're having fun and engage in such really deep and profound and inspiring conversation. So thank you for that and for all of your kind words and for the invitation to be with you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.